Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portut. Hope everyone's been good out there. I was just looking at my records. I've done a podcast an entire week, which is the longest I think we've gone since I've started the podcast a few months ago, as far as the length of time between broadcasts. So sorry about that, everybody. Just had a lot of things come up the past few days or so, but everything is all good on our front. A rainy day here in North Georgia, so went through all of that stuff, but glad that all of you are listening to me tonight here on the podcast. Tonight we're going to discuss some NBA notes over this past weekend, discuss some NCAA basketball. The NCAA tournament is coming up, and conference tournaments are starting up, started this past week and are continuing through this week into this upcoming Sunday. So we have a lot going on the NCAA front. Going to talk about some events I actually have not been able to follow over the past few weeks or so, and I'll make it all tie together in the sports season. And then finally, I'm going to talk about game announcers ruffling my feathers. So once again, welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast here on the Sports Inquirer Network. You know, during Miami's 18-game winning streak, which was actually extended on last night on Sunday with an impressive victory over the Indiana Pacers, a lot of people have been talking about the exploits and outstanding play of LeBron James, and rightfully so. He's going to win his fourth MVP at the end of the season unless something drastic happens. But you have to give respect to the other teammates as well as far as the Heat go. The storyline that hasn't been discussed as much this season, we've talked about LeBron James, talked about the Spurs having the best record in the West, the Thunder have been doing their thing, the Lakers, the melodrama that is in Los Angeles, even the emergence of the Clippers and the Nuggets and some other franchises. The reemergence of Dwayne Wade has been something that has not been discussed enough. A few years ago, he has banged up injuries pre-LeBron James. The Heat won that title a few years ago when they beat the Mavericks and with Shaquille O'Neal and had that squad going. A lot of those guys left, and you saw Wade actually succumb to some injuries and not have the elevated play that we're used to seeing from him. But even the first year that LeBron James was there, 2 years ago when they lost to the Mavericks in the finals, you kind of saw Wade regress as a player, whether it was age or injuries or just general factors of basketball. You saw him not play as well as the high standards that he set starting his career. But that's really changed in the past few weeks during the winning streak. You've seen Wade average more than 20 points per contest, being an excellent distributor of the ball, being a good secondary scorer of the James. And that's the biggest reason that the Heat have their winning streak going on right now. Even last night in the Sunday's game against the Pacers, you saw James have a season-low 18 points, which, by the way, is a really amazing fact. When your season low is 18 points, and that's what a lot of guys make millions of dollars, just to dream to average, that just shows the level of play that James is. But that's beyond the point. So James had a season low 18 points in that contest, yet you had Chalmers produce 20-plus points. Bosch contributed well. And the bench, which includes Joel Anthony, Ray Allen, Chris Anderson, giving them some post presence, especially on the defensive end, the Heat have really turned into a team from just having LeBron James there and not having major contributions from everyone else to actually having a decent bench and fitting the style of play. Now, they still struggle inside. If they have to face the Pacers for a long series or have to deal with the Bigs of San Antonio or even the Thunder to a lesser extent or the Bulls, they're going to have troubles with that. But as far as winning the championship, it's still going to be be theirs to lose. And I know I keep saying this every single podcast, and it's tiresome to me to say, and for sure to you to listen as well. But when you have an 18-game winning streak, that has to lead off my NBA thoughts and analysis. Also saw some of the Lakers and the Bulls last night when the Lakers actually got the win at home at Staples Center. The world can rejoice, and ESPN and all of the media can be excited because the Lakers officially are the 8th seed in the playoffs if the season ended today. So that's really exciting. Get to see if the season ended, we get a few more games of them. But Kobe Bryant's been outstanding as well, 40-plus points, double-digit assists the previous two games coming into that Chicago contest. Howard had another double-double, looking really good in the pick-and-roll system. Finally, it looks like he's... And I think part of it, and I've been harsh on D'Antoni, Mike D'Antoni, the head coach of the Lakers, throughout his tenure since he got there, not adjusting his system to the players and not allowing, and being stubborn and making players adjust to the system. I still think that there's still can be some improvements on that end, but at least on the offensive end, Kobe's having to do a lot, but at this stage, I mean, if he has to average 40 points the rest of the season, he's not going to make the, they're not going to make the playoffs, the Lakers. But if you see Howard continue to give you even 20 points, 10, 15 rebounds, his career averages, it's not like you're asking him to have a career year, but just an average season by Dwight Howard standards, and the Lakers are going to be the 8th seed because the Jazz are fading fast. They keep losing their games. And that's why I didn't understand the Jazz when they didn't trade Millsap or Al Jefferson. The whole reason, I guess the perception was for the Jazz front office was that we keep those two guys, and they both have expiring contracts, so they both could walk away as free agents at the end of the season. I guess I figured we keep them, we'll make the playoffs, a 7 or 8 seed, get some more experience, and then we'll just deal with it in the offseason. Well, the problem with that theory is that you're still going to end up losing to Oklahoma City or San Antonio in the first round when you get to that level, if you get the 8 or 7 seed. And furthermore, you're going to probably lose both guys to give guys like Derek Favors and a few other guys, Enes Kanter, those post players an opportunity to play more. So I don't understand that theory with the Jazz, and right now they have regressed tremendously from being as high as, I believe, a 6 or even a 5 seed maybe at points during the season. Right now they're the 9 seed. They're out of the playoffs. So you're looking at the 6, 7, 8 seeds, and that's where the Lakers are probably going to end up because that 5 seed with Memphis and Denver, they have too many games to ahead of the Lakers for them to make up, you know, by the time the season ends. So the 6th seed right now is Golden State, 7 is Houston, and number 8 are the Lakers. I can definitely see the Lakers surpassing Golden State. And if you're a fan, if you're listening to the podcast, you know I'm a big fan of the Warriors, partially because of Mark Jackson. I like Steph Curry, even Andrew Bogut, who looks like he just continues to get banged up constantly and struggling out there trying to give them some post presence. But you got Klay Thompson, David Lee, All-Star. And even he's had a sore knee the past few games. I think the Warriors are kind of, they've really reached their peak, and you're starting to see the struggles with them. And the Rockets, fun team to watch, especially when Lin is going, and Harden, who's become an all-star player. Chandler Parsons gives you a lot. I like Amir Sheik on the post, and they give you a lot as well. Problem is, they can't stop too many people. And when you have a team that scores, can average 110 points a game, but give up 115, that's going to be a problem as far as making any postseason advancements. Now, they'll probably win enough games to make the postseason, but the Lakers could surpass them as well. I could definitely see the Lakers, especially if... And it's interesting because Gasol is still out. Paul Gasol has been injured for the past few weeks and hasn't even played, and you've seen the Lakers continue this improvement. Similar to the Knicks with Amari Stoudemire when he came back, it's interesting to see how the Lakers incorporate Gasol into the rotation since Earl Clark has been taking a lot of minutes at that power forward spot, and you're starting to see the Lakers actually do better. And that's not a knock on Gasol. Gasol's an excellent player, gives you good presence on both ends of the floor. But it may be for this situation, for this season, similar to how Stoudemire for the Knicks, you want him to be a starter and get in there and play as many minutes as possible. It may be best for Gasol to come off the bench for the Lakers until the post for the rest of the regular season and coming into the postseason. So Lakers have been doing well. Another situation with DeMarcus Cousins. I'm a fan of this guy. I saw him at Kentucky while I was working at Vanderbilt. I want to see him do so well. But once again, got ejected from another contest. The Kings played Milwaukee last night. Cousins had 20 of his 24 points in the first half. Was doing really well, near perfect from the field. However, once again, he got into another altercation on the court, this time against Mike Dunleavy, threw an elbow, got ejected from the contest. And of course, the Kings lose 115-113 to Milwaukee. Now, I don't know if it's an organizational thing or if it's a DeMarcus Cousins issue or the coaching. I said even during the trade deadline, I think it would have been best for both parties to trade him. I know it's tough for a franchise to give up on a 7-foot center of DeMarcus Cousins' age and talents, and a guy who can average a double-double the rest of his career and pass the ball and can run the floor and handle the ball almost like a guard. But that situation, that combination of Sacramento and Cousins just does not meet. And I know the Kings are trying to head over to Seattle. They're working on an ownership deal with that. And they may be trying to hold on to Cousins until that deal takes place and figure a new city, new scenery, being in Seattle would be a good motivation for Cousins to mature as a player on and off the court. But I have not seen that development overall. And just that was just another example of how you can have a talented player and he cannot buy into the system, and it could just be a ruiner for the entire franchise. You know, it's just the old theory, you can't make a horse drink water, you could take him to it. It's similar to Cousins with the Kings. You have a guy who has all talent in the world, but just does not seem to buy in to becoming a major player in the league. I saw the DeAndre Jordan Brandon Knight dunk. That was very strong by the Clippers. The Clippers continue to become a highlight reel for all of the networks and for all the fans out there. A few nights ago, we had a Jamal Crawford between the legs lob for a Blake Griffin alley-oop windmill dunk. And if you're listening to the podcast, I'm sure you saw that highlight as well. And it's funny because it's good that it's funny that they're winning. You saw the reaction of the players while it was happening. You kind of got a scale of maturity levels while it was going on. Of course, starting off with the play, you had Chris Paul, MVP candidate, best point guard in the league. He threw the lob to Jordan. Jordan threw it down with his offhand, his right hand, which makes it even more impressive. Threw the dunk down. He had a little bit of a mean mug face. He kind of kept it mature, you know, for a guy who just had probably the play of the NBA season. And you saw the bench with Blake Griffin and all those guys going crazy, jumping up and down. I thought there were two interesting dynamics with that reaction. Maybe I'm playing my sports psychologist, a pseudo-analyst here. After the dunk took place, you saw Jordan. He had a little bit of a yell, he shouted, but he kept it kind of calm and cool and collected. It was funny seeing the bench, like Lamar Odom and some other veterans and Karam Butler, they acted like they'd never seen that before, and they were all excited. But you saw Chris Paul stay so calm and not even react after the dunk took place. He even went over towards Knight. He didn't help him up from the floor after he took did the foul. But you saw Paul not even have a mode of emotion. It was like a neutral reaction to all of it taking place, and I like that in a leader. I'm glad that he shows that this goes beyond just making the highlight shows and getting Twitter hits and everything like that. I'm talking about it as a fan, and that's exciting. And it's exciting for everyone involved. But the Clippers have bigger aspirations. They're still going to finish in the third seed. So, I mean, they'll host a playoff series, maybe even two. But they still have a long ways to go to reach the level of Oklahoma City and San Antonio. And I think Paul realizes that subconsciously. And that's why you didn't see the huge reaction for him over the dunk. And you saw Vinny Del Negro as well trying to keep the players on the bench so they didn't go into the floor and get technical fouls and ejections. But you also saw him stay in that calm, mature level because he realizes, similar to Paul, Del Negro's plan is coaching for his job. If the Clippers don't make the conference finals, I can definitely see Los Angeles making a big change at the coaching position. So he realizes he has to stay calm as well and keep mature and make sure that the team stays on an even keel. But just straight up, you know, if you saw it in the playground or saw that playing your rec ball at your local gym, that'd be the play of your life to see that happen. So, I mean, it was amazing to see that, but I liked seeing all the other reactions of the players, you know, while that took place. My dark horse playoff darling when I did my preseason rankings was the Minnesota Timberwolves. I thought that with Kevin Love and Ricky Rubio, AK-47, Andre Kirilenko, you know, combining and along with the post play of Niko Pekovic, I thought that the Warriors, excuse me, not the Warriors, the Wolves would actually make the playoffs. But the injuries have completely decimated that franchise. And even last night, Love, Kirilenko, and Pekovic did not even play. They didn't even suit up for the Timberwolves, and you saw them lose 100-77 to the lowly Mavericks, who have dealt with injury issues of their own as well. So, watching that contest, it continued to show me that preseason rankings or preseason predictions, any sport in general, because I'm about to do my baseball predictions starting my next podcast with some divisions, they really don't mean anything if you don't include the potential for injuries. And I'm going to get to another team, and actually I'll wrap up my NBA section with a team that's dealing with a major injury right now, two teams. And both of those teams are going to have some losses, and it's going to affect their playoff positioning most likely. And that's during the season. They had the services of those two guys for an okay amount of the season. But you have Love and Kirilenko. I mean, for Love, it may as well be a lost season. He started the season, played a little bit, broke his wrist again. He's going to try to come back and play a few more games, but this season may as well just count as an incomplete or just an L in his career. You know, as far as all the injuries go, Kirilenko's been very excellent for them, you know, giving them something on both sides of the floor. He was out. Pekovic has been a very excellent surprise for the Timberwolves in the post play. Actually a decent shooter from the outside. And then he had Rubio miss half of the season because he was recovering from his ACL tear. So the Timberwolves are just a complete mess right now. I feel bad for them because I thought that they had a chance to make the postseason and kind of do it like the Warriors and the Rockets are doing right now over in the Western Conference, but that's not going to take place. And then finally, probably the odd stat or odd game of the season was last night's 136-106 win by Portland over San Antonio in San Antonio. Tony Parker, he's out. He's still dealing with his ankle injury. And they had to start Corey Joseph at the point. And that's a problem because Damian Lillard had 35 for the Blazers, the most likely rookie of the year for Portland in the contest. And if that wasn't bad enough, Eric Maynard came off the bench and gave him 20. So he had the 2 point guards for Portland score 55 points. I don't think that a Spurs team under Popovich has ever allowed two guards at one position to score 55 points like that. And I like Damian Lillard. He's going to be the rookie of the year. Eric Maynard, he's getting some more playing time right now since he's got traded to the Thunder, from the Thunder to Portland. But there's no reason those guys should be scoring that many points, you know, in the contest. And I mean, there's nothing against Corey Joseph, but that's not the answer. Patty Mills, the former St. Mary's standout, maybe he can give him some run in that position as well, but I'm not seeing that as well. Just finally, to end that random Spurs game, some stats from Elias Sports Bureau. So the Trailblazers, they posted a 30-point victory at San Antonio, as I stated. That game was tied at halftime. And it was the first time in more than two decades since a road team that was tied or trailing by the half won by 30-plus points. And the last time that happened was the Bulls did that over the Clippers. And this is the Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen Bulls. They did that over the Clippers in November of 1991. So you're talking more than 20 years since a team tied. So in essence, it was more than 20 years since a team tied at halftime. Teams were tied at half, and the road team won by 30 more points. That just does not happen. And also for the Spurs, as I said, the Spurs are a dynasty. Popovich and Duncan, they've had an excellent run, multiple championships and all that stuff. The last time they lost by 30 or more points in a contest was against the Toronto Raptors in 1997. And for NBA fans out there, that was the year before Tim Duncan even was drafted by the Spurs. And that was the year David Robinson, I think, had a back injury and was out for the majority of that season. And the Spurs pretty much went in tank mode. It's Popovich's first year. They pretty much went in tank mode, lucked out, won the lottery, got Tim Duncan, the rest is history. So, once again, that's something that does not happen very often, and especially against a team like the Spurs with the best record in the Western Conference. That just doesn't happen. So that was just an odd random event that took place last night. And finally, the Knicks, Amari Stoudemire out 6 weeks with a knee injury. I actually feel bad for the guy because he was very productive in limited minutes, was willing to come off the bench, and was very productive and efficient in his time out there, and really helped the Knicks hold on and keep it together while Carmelo Anthony had his knee injury and was out a few games. So now what's going to happen is Knicks going to go back to pre-Amari, when actually got off to an excellent start during the season. So Carmelo's going to play the power forward, start there, besides Chandler. You're going to have Shumpert and Felton as your backcourt, and you're just going to have to figure it out from there and see what happens. So hopefully that knee injury, he can come back for the postseason and make a run. The Knicks are pretty much set at the number. They're not going to win the Eastern Conference. The Heat are going to get that. But they need to be careful as far as the rest of the postseason, as far as getting playoff positioning, because you have Brooklyn right there, Indiana, Chicago may get it together. So the Knicks can go from the 2 seed to maybe a 4 or 5 seed, the Hawks as well. And you go from being a 2 seed to maybe not even hosting your first round playoff series. And that can happen. So Knicks just need to keep it together, make sure everything is good from there. So those are my NBA thoughts. I'm going to have my power rankings out probably on Wednesday before my Thursday podcast recording. So just keep a lookout for that on the Sports Inquirer Network. Once again, you can always go to our website, sportsinquirer.net, with all the latest news and notes in the world of sports and archived podcasts. We can have archived recordings. You can always subscribe to us on iTunes. Just look under the Sports Inquirer, and you can listen to our shows on there. And shoot me an email. I haven't received too many emails yet, but I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you listeners. And that email address is sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Gonna take a little bit of a short break here, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about some NCAA basketball here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I spent the majority of my weekend over at Kennesaw State University seeing the Owls win 2 or 3 games in baseball over Evansville. So shout out to all of my Kennesaw State people that are listening out there. But also, while that was going on, I was able to rush home on Saturday and see my Belmont Bruins win their third consecutive conference championship, this time in the Ohio Valley, with the overtime victory over Murray State to make their third consecutive NCAA tournament. So all my Belmont fans out there, I know we're hyped about that. Very happy to. That was a game that was way too intense for me. Even down up here in Georgia and not being in Nashville, watching that on TV, I was a nervous wreck. Just so emotional seeing Coach Bird and that entire crew pull out that win. Ian Clark and Karan Johnson, those my boys, the senior upperclassmen who have now made 3 consecutive tournaments. I mean, that is an outstanding accomplishment for the career of those guys. And it was interesting seeing for those of you not too familiar with it, Belmont used to be in Atlantic Sun Conference for several years before the change to the Ohio Valley Conference this year. So I'm used to having the following Atlantic Sun activities between Belmont and Kennesaw State, who used to be in the same athletic conference, and following all the sports from there. However, since Belmont has made that change to the Ohio Valley and made that move, I still follow the Atlantic Sun, obviously, with my activities with the Owls. But obviously, I'm a Bruin in my heart, so, and a Commodore as well. My Vandy people, Vandy and Belmont, went to both schools, graduated from both, so I have a lot of loyalty to both of them. But at least for Saturday, I was a Bruin, and that was a really exciting game. Good victory for them. Murray State's an outstanding team as well. I was glad to see Belmont get the win, hopefully this year. I'm going to say we because I'm an alum. Hopefully we can get a good seed, get a good matchup. And the past few seasons between had to deal with Georgetown and Duke and Wisconsin a few years ago, we've actually had some tough matchups and some teams that are very physical and very tough. But Belmont has some good size inside as well. Shoot a lot of threes, get that motion offense going. So it's really fun to see the, I just call them mid-majors, as far as seeing that side of things. It's funny because as on the Belmont side of things, I'm so used to knowing that unless the Bruins win the conference tournament, the chances of them making the NCAA tournament are very low as an at-large bid. It's just the way that things work. Teams from the larger conferences or the Big Six conferences, they tend to get a lot more respect from the selection committee as far as making the tournament. So you know if you don't win that conference tournament, it's going to be very, very tough to make it. And I saw some projections that Belmont could have been an at-large team. But I'm glad I don't have to worry about that stuff and can let it be. And as a Vanderbilt fan, I've been on the other side too, where you know you're going to get an at-large, or you have a very good chance of getting an at-large bid. And then being in a conference tournament, you just want to do well in the conference tournament and contend and win one. Vanderbilt hasn't won a conference tournament, so SEC tournament, so it would have been night or in a long time. So it's always good to see them try to get a chance to win it. When Vanderbilt has a good team, it's going to make them run in the NCAA tournament. But yeah, when you're following a team that is in a one bid league or a two bid league, something like that, it really works on the emotion. So I'm glad the Bruins won. I'm looking forward to Sunday, seeing what's going to happen with the selection committee. We're going to have some good previews of the NCAA tournament next week after the bracket is released, and we have some predictions of each side. We're going to go into all of that. So I'm looking forward to the NCAA tournament. Caught up. I didn't really catch too much of the Indiana-Michigan game. Indiana's been my preseason pick to win the national championship. I've been keeping with Indiana for most of the season, and I still think they have a really good chance to win the title. And that was a really good win for them over Michigan. The Wolverines, that's another team. I've had Michigan, I've been kind of liking them as well as maybe being a Final Four team, just depending on what the seeds are and what the bracket is. But you got to make your late free throws. Robinson missing free throws. Trey Burke missed a front end of a 1-1. You miss so many free throws, you cannot have that happen. And you saw them lose at home to Indiana, you know, for that contest. Zeller really showed up. And between Zeller and Oladipo, with those two guys, you know, that's going to be a really formidable team to make a run, you know, in the NCAA tournament. I did see a decent amount of that Georgetown-Syracuse game. I'm a Syracuse fan, or I follow Syracuse. I grew up a Syracuse fan. I still follow them quite a bit. So seeing that last game of Syracuse and Georgetown, as far as being Big East opponents, that was really interesting, seeing the pictures of Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, and Jerry McNamara, and a bunch of the alums of both schools at the contest, and seeing Big John Thompson, you know, as well, seeing all that going on. I like Georgetown as a team overall, though. They got Porter and they got some other guys on there. They're going to be a sneaky Final Four contender as well if they get the right break. And you notice me saying that a lot. If they get the right break, seeing the seedings, Duke's another team, really made it a no contest. They dominated North Carolina in Chapel Hill on Saturday as well. They got Kelly back, and between Curry and Plumlee inside, Duke's going to be a formidable team as well. You cannot sleep on the Blue Devils. I still think they shoot too many three-pointers and rely on that outside shot, which all it takes is a bad shooting effort to really allow a upset to potentially take place. But Duke, you have to respect them as well. Miami is a contender. They won their first ACC title. They clinched it with the win against Clemson as well. Gonzaga, I haven't even mentioned them yet. They're the number one team in the nation in the rankings. So they're going to be a tough go as well. And there are a bunch of other teams I could probably think of that can actually be a decent squad. Florida, that was a bad loss against Kentucky. And you know the Wildcats are going to make it, by the way. There is no way that the NCAA tournament is going to take place and not have the Blue Bloods in there, including Kentucky. That's why, going back to my Belmont point, if you're looking at getting an at-large bid and it comes down to UCLA and Belmont, or even a Murray State and a Kentucky, just hypothetically, 99% of the time, you're probably going to see the Kentucky and UCLA's and Duke's, Kansas, Indiana's make the tournament over a team from the Ohio Valley or Atlantic Sun or, you know, some other programs like the MAC or the Big South. And that's just the realities of it. So Florida's loss pretty much secured Kentucky getting a bid, unless a lot happens there. And finally, and to wrap it up, everything with NCAA thoughts, conference tournaments are starting up. And our boys, the Liberty Flames, are going to be in the NCAA tournament with a record of 15-20. They finished 6-10 in the Big South. However, they had a hot run, beat Charleston Southern at the Big South Finals in Conway, South Carolina. And they're going to be in the NCAA tournament with a below 500 record. So you know they're definitely going to be playing that opening, I guess they call it the first four now, in Dayton. They're going to be the 68th team in the tournament. And I have mixed emotions on that. As I said, being a fan of teams in smaller conferences, I like the fact that you can play yourself into the NCAA tournament by winning a conference tournament. I do like that fact. But it really does diminish the tournament when you have a team with a 15-20 record, didn't even finish 500 in their conference, getting the automatic bid. Now, the alternatives, there's always two alternatives. The first alternative is you just give it to the regular season winner. And that used to be the case for a lot of conferences. The Pac-10 or Pac-12 now, well, back when they were the Pac-10, they used to do that. The Big Ten, where they didn't have a conference tournament. And the regular season winner got into the NCAAs. The Ivy League is the only conference, at least in the Division I section of the NCAAs, that still does that as far as the conference tournament. If you win the regular season, you get in automatically. And I believe Harvard won it this year, so they're going to be in there. So that's that route. Or you can really try to seed it, or the tournament, make it really, really difficult for a team like Liberty to win. You can have double byes. You can have the regular season champion host a conference tournament. Some conferences have done that. But in the end, if you go with a conference tournament, for every Cinderella story of a team getting in there that can make a big run and make things happen, you're going to have a team like Liberty. Now, true, Liberty's going to tie the record for the most losses by an NCAA tournament team. Coppin State, actually, in 2008, had 20 losses and made the tournament. So once every 5 or 6 years, you're going to have something like this happen where a 20-loss team is going to get in there. I don't know what the solution is. I like the conference tournaments a lot. Personally, I think if you finish below 500, I don't know if you should even be eligible for a conference tournament, let alone win it. Maybe that's a way to steer clear of something like this instead of having the your top 8 teams make the tournament. Maybe you make it the top 4 teams in your make your conference tournament. And if you're the top 4 teams, most likely you're going to have a winning record in conference and overall. So maybe that's something we could discuss. Send me an email about there. Tweet me at Sports Inquirer about your thoughts on that issue. So those are my thoughts on the NCAA tournament or NCAA basketball. We're prepping up for the tournament. As I said, next week we're going to have a lot of previews in relation to that. So we're going to take a little break here right now here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. And I'm going to hit up on some things that I missed this weekend and how it affects the sports or spring sports season. Here once again on the Sports Inquirer Network. You know, it was a really big weekend in the world of sports as well, besides on the basketball court. Had the World Baseball Classic going on. And it was funny because I was working the, as I was working my baseball games, some of the people in the press box were talking about the activities that were going on as far as United States playing Mexico and Venezuela and Puerto Rico and all of those teams. I had nothing to contribute to that. And I know as a sports analyst or journalist, I really try to follow a lot of things and give you a good perspective on it for myself and also for you listening out there, just give you some analysis and opinion on it. But honestly, I have not watched one pitch of World Baseball Classic. And I'm a big baseball fan. I said, we're going to do a lot of previews coming up the next few weeks. Opening day is less than a month away. I'm really excited about MLB season coming up. However, I just cannot get into the World Baseball Classic. I think the biggest reason is, well, two reasons. One, the time of year that it's in. Right now, I'm not in baseball mode. I mean, I follow it. I notice the injuries and things like that if someone major's going down and stuff like that. But I'm really not a big tracker of how the prospects are doing or the battle of positions. I really don't get too much into that. Once season starts up, I'll dip my toe into following things. And I really start following baseball probably once Memorial Day comes around. That's when I really kind of get my antennas up and really get ready to focus on following baseball. And around that time, that's when regular seasons are done for NHL and NBA. I'm really in NBA mode right now, NCAA basketball. Those are the things I'm really starting to follow right now, and other sports as well. So I think the timing of it isn't good. Also, the players. You have a lot of the top players out for various reasons, and with good purpose. I mean, because it's still the preseason for all the baseball players. So you're asking them to go from maybe getting one or two at-bats a game, pitchers maybe throwing 30 or 40 pitches in a start. They're building themselves up for the regular season, and all of a sudden you're putting them in a tournament format. I just don't understand that as far as the players' conditioning. And hopefully there aren't too many injuries, because there's going to be an injury. Some major star, major player from one of these countries is going to tear something or break something, unfortunately, and they're going to be out for their major league team. So honestly, if I obviously I'm a United States citizen, I want the U.S. to win as many competitions as possible. But if I was the owner of a team and I had some American players and the United States was eliminated, I would not be sad over that as a business owner. I'm like, good, getting back to our spring training facility so we can continue playing and under our terms. And so that's one thing I don't like as far as the timing and the lack of players. Personally, I would like for them, if they're really going to commit to this, and I don't know what the Major League Baseball Union and the commissioner and the offices, what their thoughts are. If they really want to make this right, they have to do like the NHL does when the Olympics comes around, Winter Olympics. They have to eliminate the All-Star game, just block out 2 or 3 weeks, and really make a go at it, and have it in the United States. I mean, it's going to have to be co-hosted by United States. And just have different fields, L.A., Arizona, Chicago, New York, wherever. I don't care where you host it, as far as the different cities in the United States. Because the United States has the best facilities and the most stadiums to host a tournament of a large magnitude. So that's all what you need to do is just have it in the middle of July and just block out 2-3 weeks for it and really make the incentive of it being the best players in the world competing for the top title. And that's another thing about the World Baseball Classic. I don't even know what the prize is. Do you get a trophy? Do you get a medal? Do you just get Chris Domino here in Atlanta, one of his big things is playing for a bucket of pride. That's when I steal that phrase all the time, so have to give the credit to him if I'm going to say it on an internet broadcast. But what do you win for this? I mean, I don't understand what the prize is. So if you are going to play for something and have you represent your country, and I'm all for international competition. I love when people represent their countries and compete at a high level, but I don't know what the prize is, and I don't know what really. I know Japan, I think, won it the last time, and if I have to think about who won the tournament the last time, that's not really a good tournament. And another thing I unfortunately missed, I didn't see too much of the NASCAR race. I know that Matt Kenseth won in Las Vegas, and I know there was some griping about the Gen 6 car. I really didn't catch too much of the racing this week as far as a NASCAR front, so not too much analysis there, but I want to acknowledge all of you NASCAR fans out there. I do follow it a lot, and but this week was just, it just didn't fit into the cards for me to do that. NHL, Power Rank is probably coming later on this week, or just some general NHL thoughts. The Blackhawks have lost. They've lost two games in a row, actually. They had that really big loss to Minnesota, and they just lost at home to Edmonton as well. I think the score was 6-5, so giving up a lot of goals there. They actually have, they've played, I think, 7 games in 11 days with this lockout, or the lockout took place in the NHL, so really condensed season, and they had a really bad stretch of consecutive games and back-to-back, so their next game is on Thursday, which is really good. Hopefully they can relax, and for the Blackhawks' sake, and get it together. They're still going to be a cup contender, but as I said, I've been saying for the past few weeks, even with the streak of not losing in regulation, they still haven't gotten that much distance from Vancouver and Anaheim, so they're right there as far as the postseason. They'll probably be the number one seed. I mean, the Blackhawks are still a really good team, but watch out for those other teams as well. Even the Kings, I think they're in the 4 or 5 seed right now. They're starting to get their act together as well. The defending champs are getting back into form, so they're going to be formidable as well. I'm looking so forward to the playoffs in the NHL this season. I think this may be you're going to see probably a 7 or 8 seed make the finals, just the way things are shaping up. And even on the Eastern Conference, all you got to do is make the playoffs. That's even more wide open than the West. I think in the West, you're kind of see a line of demarcation. I think you have Chicago, Vancouver, Anaheim, those teams. Not much of a dip per se. I don't think that's the right term, but you can kind of see those three teams kind of separating themselves. In the East, it is wide open. I actually see Pittsburgh making a run right now. You have Boston and Montreal competing for first place in the Eastern Conference. But either of those teams could get hot. I can see the New Jersey. They have as long as you have goalkeeping and play good defense, you're going to be in it. The Rangers could make a run. Carolina, you know, as long as you make the postseason, even Toronto, if they get their goalkeeping injuries together, they can make a run as well. So it's a wide open in the Eastern Conference as far as any teams that could be represented in there and win. So I didn't see too much in the NHL, but I did notice those stats. Kind of similar to when I always joke with the, you know, because I do follow a lot of sports, and I'll talk rugby or even some cricket action or EPL soccer or international soccer as far as the domestic and international activities. The one sport I just do not get into, at least as far as the major, until it's the majors, is golf. I don't know if it's just the pace of the game or just not being from playing the game myself too much. On TV, it does look nice. I like nature. I'm a gardener myself, so I can appreciate a good lie or some good lawn mowing. I can acknowledge that, so I do appreciate the visuals of it. As far as the game itself goes, I mean, I'll watch the final day of the four majors. I do like getting up early, seeing the British Open on Sunday morning, and following the Masters into Sunday night and everything like that. But I did see that Tiger Woods, he won a second tournament of the year. He won at Doral, and I've been reading by the golf analyst that this makes him a favorite to win the Masters. And if there's one golf course that does fit Tiger, I do know this much, it's going to be in Augusta. So him being involved is definitely an excellent situation. I like seeing Rory McIlroy. The emergence of him has been really good on a lot of levels. Phil Mickelson's always a major player. Bubba Watson winning last year, a local guy here in Georgia, really big story around here, so that was fun to see. But we need Tiger to be involved in a major way at a major. That alliteration is needed. He needs to be a major player at a major to really get that attention from everyone involved as far as sports fans. And it's always fun when he's involved if he's a few shots ahead or a few shots behind. He just has that charisma and that excitement, and you know that talent is still there. You don't go from being one of the on a short list of best golfers ever to no show in that quick amount of time. I mean, I know we all know the stories of injuries. He's had some leg injuries and then all the off the course stuff, but you don't lose all of that talent that quickly, just like that. So it's still there. Can he put it together for 4 consecutive days at a major? That's the biggest thing. Will his putting hold up? You know, everything like that. So seeing him actually winning tournaments is a good thing. And I know everyone, even the competitors, are happy because when Tiger's involved, everyone's happy. The TV ratings are up. The players, they get more money. Everyone gets more money when he's involved. He's elevated the value of the tour and golf in general on such a high level. So seeing him win was really good. Some NFL activities since we were talking. Percy Harvin is now a Seahawk. They gave up a first-round pick and I think a later-round pick. I have to see the compensation. I think they're trying to settle that. But I definitely know it's the first-rounder for this year. So you're going to have Sidney Rice and Percy Harvin as your receivers for Russell Wilson and Zach Miller as well at tight end, including Marshawn Lynch at running back. So the Seahawks are making their big move. They have the best secondary in the league, and their defense is solid. And then you add Percy Harvin, who, if he's healthy and has the right attitude, and those are two things that he struggled with at Minnesota, the attitude and the health. And we talked about it a few podcasts ago. As I said, I wouldn't touch him as far as if I was trading for him. But I think if you're Seattle, it's an interesting move because their first rounder is going to be in the 20s. And, you know, in the late round pick, you don't even know if they're even going to make the team. So you get a excellent player, a Pro Bowl caliber player, an excellent return man. You get that for your offense that could use a vertical attack. And Harmon's versatility is going to be excellent for Seattle. I like him in that situation, in that city, with that coaching staff. So the only handful of teams I would have seen him possibly going to and making it work. And the Seahawks were one of them. So that's a really big move for them. Also, Antoine Bolden was traded to San Francisco. I think it was for a 5th or 6th round pick. He had a monster postseason and became a really big threat for Joe Flacco in the playoffs and all their wins. I know they were trying to restructure the contract for him, but I don't understand how you sign Joe Flacco to the technically the richest contract in NFL history and you get rid of his major threat. And yes, I know they have some good tight ends. They have Torrey Smith on the outside. And it's economics. It's just a salary cap age. You can't keep everybody. But I just thought they could have found a way to keep him and make that happen. And hopefully, I mean, they're still going to rely on Ray Rice. And I said they got Smith on the outside, two Pro Bowl caliber players. And they got some other offensive weapons as well. But it's always tough when you have to trade away a guy who became your best receiver during the postseason. So that's going to be an interesting move for Baltimore's side. San Francisco, with Randy Moss's departure and Mario Manningham's inconsistencies, you give Kaepernick another valuable player. So Kaepernick obviously has Vernon Davis, the all-pro caliber tight end. You get Michael Crabtree at the outside with Manningham. And now you get, as an Antoine Bolden, you get three receivers. Three wide receivers and a tight end, along with Frank Gore and LaMichael James and Dixon at that three-headed running back core. They're continuing to make themselves a Super Bowl participant favorite from the NFC with all of these moves. You have to see what they do on the defensive end, but if they pull off that trade for Darrelle Revis, that's definitely going to put them in there. Because that's the one weak link they kind of do have, the 49ers, is some outside corners. And you saw them get taken advantage of some parts by the Falcons in the NFC Championship game and definitely by the Ravens in the Super Bowl. So if they get that taken care of, that's going to be a really good move. So those are some NFL notes. We're going to have a lot more analysis of the free agency is going to actually start up by the time you're listening to this podcast. So we're going to have some trades and some more roster moves since guys have been franchised already and everything like that. So we're going to see all of that happen before within the next few weeks before the draft. So there'll be plenty of NFL talk. NFL talk goes on all day, every day, here in the Sports Inquirer Network, and I know in your offices and in your homes. So those are some NFL thoughts, and I'm going to wrap up this edition of the podcast with how TV announcers have ruffled my feathers. When I was younger, back in the La Casa back in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, New York, one of the biggest things that I would do is not listen to the announcers on the TV and turn on the radio and listen to the guys on the broadcast, on the radio. Now, we're talking back in the day, I'm going to date myself, we had the legendary Marv Albert doing NBA games as far as the Knicks go. We had Murphy, the legendary Mets announcer, the Hall of Famer, doing the broadcast for the Mets, and numerous other guys doing some great activities from there, living in New York. Now, as a young man, I actually enjoyed some of the... Those guys are veterans, professionals, but I like the little subtle biases that you can kind of hear on the radio while watching it on television. If a Ranger or a Knick didn't do something so well, they didn't really go hard on them. Clyde Frazier was the best at it with the Knicks, where if a Knick messed up, it was like, oh, his effort was, and use a big dictionary word I couldn't even figure out. But you never heard him knock the team completely in that way. And I kind of liked that as a young man. But then I got older and realized that I want my journalist or my announcers to keep it neutral, and I preferred them not to root for any team. And two highlights came to light in the past few weeks of, I thought, broadcasters kind of overstepping their bounds and showing their biases in interesting ways. First was Dick Vitale during the Duke-Miami game in Durham. Now, we all know that Dick Vitale has had a strong love of Duke basketball. I think that's just blatantly apparent if you listen to it. And for North Carolina and some other teams out there, but Duke tends to be his biggest one. Now, it was an exciting game. Duke and Miami top five teams coming into that clash. Ryan Kelly was coming back for his first game in a few months or so. I understand he was hyped and excited to be in that arena and be in that atmosphere. I've been there. It's an exciting atmosphere to watch any contest. However, his continual bias towards Duke really turned me off. The Miami players were working just as hard and were executing very well throughout that contest. But when Miami would do something well, it was like, okay, that's a good player. If a Duke player did well, and they did very well in that contest, that's not a knock on the Blue Devil players. If Kelly made a three-pointer, or you saw Plumlee get a big rebound, or Curry make a three-pointer, his excitement level for that was so much higher than if a Miami Hurricane player did well. And as I said, I don't have a dog in that fight, whether Duke does well or Miami, but just seeing that was a turnoff and took away from that experience. The second one was a little more personal. We had Adrian Branch cover the Murray State-Belmont game that I talked about earlier. And it's funny because I thought throughout that contest, he seemed to be siding towards Murray State with his analysis of the contest. And Murray State played an excellent game, as I stated earlier. Excellent players there. But it seemed like every time Murray did something well, it was like they seemed like they were getting a lot more love and attention than if a Belmont player did well. Now, that one, I do have a biased view because I am a Bruin. I do follow Belmont, and I noticed it a lot more on that side of things. So, interesting that we look at our broadcasters and our analysis and how we have to not do what we say not to do to experience it better. And I wear two hats. I said I have my favorite teams that I follow both professionally and collegiately. But as an analyst, I will criticize them immediately if it's an issue. I will talk bad about my brother and my mother and my father if they are not performing well and it's my job to analyze it. I do not care. But I have to also realize that if I'm listening to somebody else, I have to eliminate those biases as well. And going back to the Belmont-Murray game, when I was working the game at Kennesaw State baseball game yesterday, one of my fellow coworkers said that he thought that the announcer really liked Belmont more than Murray State. So that just shows you that maybe my biases or my views skewed my perspective on things. And now we have, if you look deeper into analysis. It ties into journalism in general overall, because we have between the ESPNs and NBC Sports Network and now the launch of Fox Sports One, we have conferences and teams making contracts with the entities that are broadcasting them. It goes beyond listening to the local New York Knicks broadcast for me and knowing that those guys are going to have a little bit of a different view, a positive view towards the team that's employing them and hiring them. What happens when that becomes a conference issue or even an entire sport issue? But where do we draw the line as far as our biases and our criticism and our critiques of the entities that we are broadcasting and following? Once again, thank you for listening to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast here on the Sports Inquirer Network. We're going to have this episode up very soon. Next broadcast, we're going to have a guest, Spencer, from this Facebook page, Sports Minds of America. He's going to talk about his fan page and his projects in relation to that. Also going to talk about a preview of the UFC event between George St. Pierre and Nick Diaz, the main event taking place this Saturday in Montreal. Also going to preview some baseball as well, probably preview the AL East and the NL East. So once again, this is the latest edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. Please go to us on thesportsinquirer.net. We're on iTunes as well. Subscribe to us. Send us an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com or send us a message on Twitter at Sports Inquirer. I check it every day. If you send me something really good, I'll retweet it, even give you a shout out here on the broadcast. So once again, thank you for listening. Good fight. Good night.